Israel stepping up its crackdown on Palestinians following Friday's retaliatory attack in occupied Al-Quds that left 7 Israelis dead. For the 4th consecutive week, Tel Aviv witnesses a massive rally against the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his policies. And amid protests in the U.S. city of Memphis, authorities disband the special police unit whose officers fatally beat a young black man. Thanks for joining us. Israel is taking a range of escalatory measures in response to the shooting attacks in occupied Al-Quds. Those include making it easier for Israelis to obtain gun permits and encouraging those with licenses to carry their weapons. The regime also said that it will demolish the homes of suspected Palestinian attackers and revoke certain rights of their families, including their social security benefits. Israel has also promised new steps to expand illegal settlements in the occupied West Bank. The Israeli military is also sending more troops into occupied Al-Quds. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had earlier pledged a, quote, strong, swift, and precise response to the deadly shooting attacks. He said the regime is prepared for any scenario. In the meantime, Israeli forces have killed yet another Palestinian man near the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. The man was shot dead near the Kedumim settlement, located east of Qalqilya. Israeli media claimed the Palestinian was in possession of a gun and suspicious of carrying out a shooting operation. This as Israeli troops are on alert following 2 shooting operations in the occupied Al-Quds. The first incident happened on Friday when a Palestinian man killed 7 settlers near a synagogue there. The second one happened on Saturday when a 13-year-old Palestinian boy injured 2 Israelis. The incidents follow an Israeli raid on the Jenin refugee camp in the occupied West Bank that claimed the lives of 9 Palestinians on Thursday. A correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kandil, gives us more details on the Israeli regime's most recent act of deadly violence against Palestinians in the occupied Al-Quds.
The 18-year-old Karam Suleiman from the village of Qusin, west Nablus, was shot dead by the Israeli forces as he clashed with the Israeli forces near the illegal settlement of Kedumim, east Qalqilya. It seems that Palestinians know very well that a reaction to the ongoing and non-stop Israeli illegal practices and policies and crimes, then they are left with nothing but to be adherent to the choice of resistance. Now, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu last night convened a meeting for the security cabinet, and after this meeting, they decided a number of issues. Netanyahu promised a strong, swift, and precise response in the wake of the operation that was carried out by a Palestinian, Khayri Alqam, 21-year-old from Al-Quds, that left 7 Israelis killed and a number of others were wounded. It's the deadliest operation in years, according to the Israeli military.
There are no signs of a let-up in Israeli aggression against Palestinian people. The regime demolished the home of a Palestinian citizen in the south of occupied Al-Quds. Israeli authorities also sealed the home of a Palestinian who was killed in a recent anti-Israeli operation in Al-Quds. Israeli settlers also set fire to the home and the vehicle of a Palestinian in the northern occupied West Bank city of Ramallah. The Israeli regime has been pressing ahead with demolishing Palestinian homes as part of its land grab policy. Israeli settlers, backed by the regime, also keep raiding and destroying Palestinian property. Tens of thousands of Israelis have hit the streets of Tel Aviv for the 4th consecutive week to protest against Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's judicial reforms. Protesters chanted slogans and held banners depicting Netanyahu and his ministers. They expressed their disapproval of what they called a fascist cabinet and his proposed reforms meant to increase political power. The Israeli cabinet says the reforms are needed to curb overreach by activist judges. that has drawn fierce opposition from groups, including lawyers. Netanyahu returned to power as the head of a coalition with extreme right and ultra-Orthodox parties. The cabinet is planning to hand over more powers to lawmakers in appointing judges and overriding the rulings of the regime's apex court. The coalition also intends to intensify the expansionist policy with more settler units or settlement units in the occupied West Bank. Iran's defense ministry says it has repelled a drone attack on one of its workshops in central Iran. In a statement, the ministry said the workshop, located in the central city of Isfahan, came under attack by three mini drones. It said one of the drones was hit by the air defense, and the other two were caught in defense traps and blew up. It added that the unsuccessful attack did not cause any loss of life and caused minor damage to the workshop's roof. The ministry noted the attack also did not cause any disruption to the workshop's operations. Iran's president says friendly relations between Tehran and Baku have been based on strong culture and historic ties. Ibrahim Raisi made the remarks in a phone call with his Azeri counterpart, Ilham Aliyev. Raisi said the governments of Tehran and Baku will not allow the ill-wishers to exploit friendly relations between the two countries. He was referring to a recent incident at the embassy of Azerbaijan Republic in Tehran, which resulted in the death of one Azeri diplomat. The president expressed deepest condolences over the matter, noting that relevant authorities are following up on the case. For his part, Aliyev said the Friday incident was an unprecedented attack. He stressed that the Republic of Azerbaijan will not allow for the disruption of Baku-Tehran relations under the pretext of such incidents. A 5.9 magnitude earthquake has struck northwestern Iran, killing three and injuring hundreds more. The quake hit the city of Hoy in West Azerbaijan province late evening, and aftershocks continued for several hours. It left many buildings partially or totally destroyed. Relief operations are underway despite the cold weather. The Iranian president's first vice president has ordered the mobilization of all possible resources to help the affected areas. Iran's Red Crescent says 417 tons of aid, including tents, blankets, and food, is on the way to the region. Just weeks ago, the region was also rattled by a 5.8 magnitude quake, which left hundreds injured. Iran sits astride the boundaries of several major tectonic plates and experiences frequent seismic activity. The Iranian Foreign Ministry says Canada's government should answer for its dark history as more graves of indigenous children are discovered there. The ministry spokesman says the latest findings point to a great human tragedy that can only be described as genocide. Nasser Kanani said such crimes took place in a country whose government hypocritically seeks to portray itself as an advocate of human rights and interferes in the affairs of other states. The investigative team has found 66 more potential unmarked graves at a former residential school in British Columbia. That brings to 159 the number of graves found at that particular school. Canada forcibly sent more than 150,000 Indigenous children to residential schools between 1831 and 1996 to assimilate them into white Canadian society. Truth Commission found that thousands of students died of malnutrition, disease, and neglect in those schools. Around 2,000 graves have been uncovered so far. World Cancer Day is an international day marked on February the 4th to raise awareness of cancer and to encourage its prevention, detection, and treatment. In Iran, the occasion is marked by an annual international symposium where the latest accomplishments are presented. Gisumi Shahmedi has more.
Celebrating progress in treating cancer. Ahead of World Cancer Day, scientists at the forefront of cancer research gathered in the Iranian capital to share their latest accomplishments in the fourth International Cancer Symposium held at Royan Research Institute, dubbed From Bench to Bedside. Results of the latest experiments on cancer cell therapy were presented to an international audience of academic and private physicians and researchers.
We've been able to improve cancer survival with new treatments that include cell therapy. We are in collaboration with all of the top healthcare centers in the country. Over the past couple of years, we managed to build a reputation for Iranian healthcare specialists in the region, and we've managed to gain a foothold in health tourism. Now our advancement in cell therapy opened new horizons for cancer patients as well.
We are now moving on to cellular therapies designed to improve the immune system's ability to fight cancer. This includes collecting a specific set of cells from the patient's blood and modifying them to produce a more vigorous attack on cancer cells, and then re-injecting them into the patient's body.
On the sidelines of the conference, an exhibition of research-based therapeutic achievements was held, introducing advanced cellular treatments.
We are becoming more and more competent in treating cancer, and truth be told, in many cases, cancer patients do not even need to go through chemotherapy anymore. Cell therapy is now leading to very good results, especially in children with brain cancer, according to our field research, and also in treating breast cancer.
World Cancer Day aims to prevent millions of deaths every year by raising awareness and education about cancer and pressing governments and individuals across the world to take action against the disease. But public funds are limited, and therefore financial assistance from charity organizations is indispensable.
Researchers taking part in this conference are saying regular donations allows them to fund new treatments that can help cancer patients. Therefore, one of the most important issues here is to find new ways to allocate charity funds to cancer research and treatment. Gizum Shahmadi, Tehran.
The U.S. City of Memphis has disbanded the special police unit whose officers fatally beat a young man. The Memphis Police Department said that it was in the best interest of all to permanently deactivate the unit. That came after protesters took to the streets in Memphis and other U.S. cities. They demanded justice for the death of Tyre Nichols after a video was released showing police violently arresting the young black man. He died a few days after the incident. About five officers involved in the incident have been charged with murder, assault, and kidnapping, among other charges. Police brutality against the people of color has been a major source of public outcry in the U.S. This issue was most prominently thrown into the spotlight after the police killing of George Floyd in the year 2020. A correspondent in Washington, Colin Campbell, tells us more about the growing outrage in the U.S. over police brutality, especially against minorities.
You are now hearing more calls for police reforms, for police culture to change, for the pathology to be diminished of these teams of police officers that seem to operate above the law. We do know that this Scorpion unit, the elite teams unit that was part of the police force that actually encountered Nichols, has now been disbanded. And this was about four teams of 10 police officers each that were specialized in auto theft incidents, high crime incidents, drugs, things like that. These teams have been disbanded. Now, what does that mean as far as the implications for crime in Memphis, where crime can be high? I think a lot of people are questioning that now. However, this also helps to diminish some of the anger coming from the community, because it does seem like the police department is doing something about it.
At least one protester has been killed in the Peruvian capital, Lima, as anti-government protesters clashed with security forces. Angry protesters hurled projectiles at the riot police, who responded by firing tear gas and pellets. The latest death brings to nearly 60 the number of people killed in Peru's unrest. The country has been mired in political crisis after the ouster of former President Pedro Castillo in December. He is now in pretrial detention over attempts to dissolve Congress. Since then, his supporters have been protesting across the country. They're demanding his release and want his successor, President Dina Boluarte, to step down and early elections to be held. However, Peru's Congress has turned down Boluarte's request to advance the polls from the previously scheduled 2026 to 2024, and even earlier to the end of this year. Following a week of desecration of the Holy Quran in the Netherlands and Sweden, UK Muslims have joined global protests to vent their anger and hurt. Sweden's embassy in London was the location targeted for the demo, which saw Muslims burning flags and reciting Quran verses.
Hundreds of angered Muslim protesters converged on the Swedish embassy in London to condemn the recent desecration of Islam's holy book. Protesters came from across the UK in order to make their upset clear and to pressure European governments to take anti-Muslim hate more seriously.
This is the latest example of a protest to take place as anger across the Muslim world remains incredibly high. This week alone, there have been numerous Quran-burning protests and promises by right-wing activists to continue the pressure. As the protests continue, the anger will continue to grow too.
We live for Quran. The Quran is very respectful. The Holy Quran is not our word, not our book. It's the book from Allah, then has to be very respectful.
This should stop because this is our human right, as well as the European laws, as we are living in European continent. The European law states that every religion and their religious leadership must be respected.
On Monday, a Dutch politician tore apart a copy of the Holy Quran in the city of The Hague. It followed an incident in Sweden where a politician burned a copy of the Quran outside the Turkish embassy. These extremists have been receiving authorities' permission to conduct the heinous acts, even provided police protection under the guise of freedom of expression. Mosques, Muslim-strong residential areas, and embassies belonging to Muslim countries have all been the target of these Islamophobic incidents. This blatant state facilitation of anti-Islam extremism has led many Muslims to feel vulnerable in a continent which claims to defend minority and religious rights. Robert Carter, London.
Polls have opened in Tunisia for a runoff in a parliamentary election that was marked by a turnout of only 11% in the first round. With political parties boycotting the vote, most candidates are independents, and attention is likely to focus on whether there will be higher participation than in December. President Kassaid has decreed that the new mostly powerless parliament as part of a reconfigured presidential system. He shut down the previous parliament in 2021 and assumed broad control over the state. Saeed's critics say the voter apathy in the first round has undermined his claims of public support for sweeping political change. They accuse him of seeking to dismantle the democratic system that was established after Tunisia's 2011 revolution. And that is it for World News. Bye-bye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Enmity of arrogant powers towards Iran originates from Leather's anti-arrogance and colonialist spirit. This is the part of a televised speech delivered on January 9, 2022 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the anniversary of an uprising by the people of Qom on January 9, 1978.
The January 9th uprising was a brilliant combination of zeal and rationality. These events form our history and we must learn from them. But a nation that is alive does not look only at the past. It also looks at the next step to be taken and the horizons ahead in every stage of its history. In accordance with the developments of its time and in accordance with the duties that fall on that nation. We must identify the task to be done at the present moment. We must determine our steps for the future. And we must identify the horizon, fix our eyes on it, and move towards it with all our strength and power. In this way, the movement will be successful in the real sense of the word. In addition, it will achieve the final victory, which is first of all a pure life for the Iranian nation. If others learn from it, and if it becomes a model, this is another issue. But we should achieve prosperity and an Islamic lifestyle, which is a pure life that has worldly comforts, has both religion and welfare, and is good for both the body and the soul.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
At the present time, we are in the middle of the path. Of course, part of the way has been travelled up until today. The Iranian nation has worked hard, and we have moved forward a little. But we should identify what our duty is today and what our duty and horizons are for the future as well. Sometimes one sees that they carry out polls. For example, they ask the opinion of the people. But these things do not show the truth of the Iranian nation. The truth of the Iranian nation is shown by the funeral of Martyr Soleimani. It is these things that show the mood of the Iranian nation and what their sentiments and feelings are. In other words, in order to understand the reality and feelings of this nation, a domain as great and vast as the country and people of Iran is needed. Therefore, the polls that some groups carry out here and there, some of which have ulterior motives behind them, and some of which are innocent, cannot be a criterion in this regard.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
In an article published on Responsible Statecraft, it is said that the U.S. role in Ukraine has slowly escalated since the beginning of the war there almost a year ago, saying the question now is how far Washington is willing to go. When the U.S. involves itself in a conflict, it often finds it difficult to get itself out. For instance, it happened in Vietnam. The U.S. military advisors helping the South Vietnamese fight Viet Cong forces eventually became U.S. soldiers fighting an American war. Or in Afghanistan, an initial invasion under the pretext of fighting Al-Qaeda terrorists morphed into 2 decades of war and destruction that resulted in the death of hundreds of thousands of Afghans. The same scenario could be unfolding in Ukraine. Less than a month into the Ukraine war, the US President Joe Biden stated that the US and NATO allies would not fight Russia in Ukraine. However, little by little, Washington and NATO are creeping closer to the catastrophic scenario Biden had described as World War III. Biden had also claimed the US troops will not be sent to Ukraine to take part in the conflict. However, several current and former American intelligence officials told The Intercept back in October that there is a much larger presence of both CIA and US special operations personnel in Ukraine than there was when the war began, saying they are conducting clandestine American operations in the country that are now far more extensive. An 8-year Army Special Operations veteran, who is now an investigative journalist, reported in December that among those covert operations is the CIA's work with an unnamed NATO allies spy agency to carry out sabotage operations within Russia. Reportedly, the cause of the unexplained explosions that have rocked Russian infrastructure throughout the war. Meanwhile, the United States and its NATO allies have serially blown past their own self-imposed lines over arms transfers. At the start of the war, analysts cautioned that the overt supply of even small arms and light weaponry risks encouraging a wider war and possible retaliation from Moscow, while US officials ruled out more advanced weaponry as too escalatory. It took less than 2 months for the Biden administration to start sending these more risky tranches of high-powered arms. By the end of May, it was sending advanced rocket systems. In addition, NATO arms transfers have now escalated well beyond what governments had worried just months ago could draw the alliance into direct war with Russia, with the US and European governments now sending armored vehicles and planning to send tanks. Russia has warned the United States against its planned delivery of Abrams tanks to Ukraine. Anatoly Antonov, Russia's ambassador to the United States, has described the move as a blatant provocation against Moscow. He accused Washington of purposefully trying to inflict a strategic defeat on Russia. The warning came before the U.S. announced the delivery of dozens of its main battle tanks to Ukraine. Two American officials have been quoted as saying that the timeline of any potential delivery remains unclear and could take months or even years. Washington has said previously that providing Abrams tanks to Ukraine is not feasible, citing difficulties in training and maintenance. Meanwhile, German Chancellor Olaf Scholz has decided to send Leopard 2 tanks to Ukraine and to allow other countries such as Poland to send the same tanks from their own stockpiles to Kyiv. Until now, Berlin had been hesitant to send the Leopards or to allow other nations that have them in their possession to transfer them to Kyiv, with reports early last week saying that Germany would agree to do so only if the US provided its own tanks. The decision by the US to send its Abrams seems to have provided the political cover that Berlin had been seeking. Ukrainian officials have said the tanks would be a game-changer on the battlefield. The country's president, Volodymyr Zelensky, has called for a large number of tanks to repel Russian attacks.
Today, by the way, there's a lot of talk about tanks, about modern tanks that we need, and about the way this shortfall can be filled. A lot of efforts, words, promises. But it is important not to lose sight of reality. It is not about 5 or 10 or 15 tanks. The need is larger.
Zelensky said that Ukraine's allies have the required number of tanks to strengthen the country's defense against Russia. Since the beginning of the war, Ukraine's allies have sent Kyiv tens of billions of dollars worth of weapons. Western countries have also imposed a slew of economic sanctions on Moscow. Now, by escalating their support for Ukraine's military, the US and NATO have created an incentive structure for Moscow to take a drastic, aggressive step to show the seriousness of its own red lines.
The confrontation between Russia and the West is getting more complicated after Germany and the United States announced their decisions to send advanced tanks to Kyiv.
The U.S. is sending 31 Abrams battle tanks to Ukraine. Biden told reporters at the White House that the tanks highlight America's enduring commitment to Ukraine.
Today, I'm announcing that the United States will be sending 31 Abrams tanks to Ukraine, the equivalent of one Ukrainian battalion. Secretary Austin has recommended this step because it will enhance the Ukraine's capacity to defend its territory and achieve its strategic objectives. The Abrams tanks are the most capable tanks in the world. They're also extremely complex to operate and maintain. So we're also giving Ukraine the parts and equipment necessary to effectively sustain these tanks on the battlefield.
The reversal of the U.S.'s previous position came after Germany said it will send 14 of its Leopard 2 tanks to Ukraine. Berlin has also given permission to partner countries to re-export other battle tanks to Kiev. Biden has praised the decision by Germany and stressed on what he called Western unity against Russia. Germany was reluctant to send tanks to Ukraine and was waiting for the U.S. to take the front lead. Britain had earlier announced that it would give Ukraine its Challenger tanks. While Berlin was concerned about escalating the war, Washington cited logistical and maintenance challenges. Western nations had so far refused to give heavy armored vehicles to Ukraine. Kiev is now pushing its Western allies to deliver fourth-generation fighter jets, such as the American F-16. But the German Chancellor Olaf Scholz says there is no chance of any fighter jets being sent to Ukraine, despite renewed calls for high-end aircraft. Ukraine's Air Force has a fleet of aging Soviet-era fighter jets. Western military support has been vital for Kiev.
I follow the debate closely surrounding these tanks. You know, you do have a number of German officials and experts, commentators saying we can't have German tanks, you know, on the border with Russia again. This evokes terrible memories of World War II. But the counter argument to this is, because you hear a lot about Russia, is if you look at how Nazi Germany invaded the Soviet Union, it invaded it through Ukraine and Belarus. So Germany also has a historic responsibility.
By announcing its decision to send Leopard tanks to Ukraine, Germany is now actively involved in the war with Russia. The German foreign minister has said that Germany and its allies are, quote, fighting a war against Russia. Comments have been described as rare and frank remarks about the Western role in the conflict. Sergei Nechayev, Russia's ambassador to Germany, said this extremely dangerous decision takes the conflict to a new level of confrontation and contradicts the statements of German politicians about Germany's unwillingness to get involved in it. Russia has harshly criticized the decision by NATO members to send heavy weaponry to Ukraine as a blatant provocation. The Kremlin has said that any Abrams battle tanks supplied to Ukraine by the U.S. would, quote, burn. Russian officials have dismissed the expected delivery as an expensive folly. The U.S. Defense Department announced in early January 2023 that it would give an additional $3.1 billion in military aid to Ukraine. In total, the U.S. approved about $50 billion in aid for Ukraine in 2022. About half of that money, or $24.9 billion, went towards military spending. The U.S. also gave $9.6 billion to Ukraine for what it has described as non-military purposes in 2022. It is believed that the small number of Western-supplied tanks manned by poorly trained crews and lacking maintenance and supply infrastructure support is likely to yield negative results. Furthermore, the first deployment of U.S. main battle tanks in Ukraine must come by a significant Ukrainian army success. That would require no fewer than 200 to 300 tanks. The question is whether Western countries are prepared to go for a full-blown confrontation with Russia.
The two biggest economies in South America are starting talks to create a common currency. Brazil's president, Luiz Inácio da Silva, and Argentina's president, Alberto Fernández, wrote in a joint piece published in Argentinian paper Perfil that they wanted to foster greater integration between the two neighbors. The pair said they had decided to move forward with discussions about a common South American currency that could be used for financial and commercial flows, reducing operating costs and other external vulnerability.
What we're trying to work on right now is to have our finance ministers, each with their economy teams and with a lot of debate and meetings, flow the foreign trade and transaction between the two countries with a common currency.
The announcement came as Lula has visited Argentina for his first trip abroad since taking office at the start of the month. At a press conference in Buenos Aires, he said establishing a common currency for trade would reduce reliance on the U.S. dollar, whose sharp ascent last year was painful for countries around the world. Lula said, if it depended on me, we would have external commerce always in the same currency of the other countries, so we wouldn't have to depend on the dollar. The Financial Times had previously reported, citing Argentina's economy minister Sergio Massa, that the neighboring nations would announce this week they were starting work on a common currency. Massa indicated that though initially a bilateral project, the initiative would be offered to other nations in Latin America, adding it's Argentina and Brazil inviting the rest of the region. Argentina and Brazil are both part of the Mercosur trade bloc, which also includes Paraguay and Uruguay. Talk of creating a common currency has periodically cropped up since its founding in 1991. Brazil is Argentina's largest trade partner. It's the top destination for Argentine exports, amounting to 14.3% and $12.7 billion in 2022. Close to 20% of Argentina's imports are from Brazil, worth just over $16 billion last year. Emerging markets have also been hit hard by the strong US dollar, drawing complaints about its dominance in the global financial system. The greenback rallied nearly 8% against a basket of major currencies in 2022, making imports of food and energy more expensive. Over 24 countries have been the target of unilateral or partial trade sanctions for not adhering to the policies of the US and other Western powers. These limitations, nevertheless, have turned out to be detrimental to the economies of the group of seven nations and have begun to impact the US dollar's hegemony in the world. The International Monetary Fund recorded a decline in central bank holdings of US dollar reserves during the fourth quarter of 2020, which went from 71% to 59%, reflecting the US dollar's waning influence on the world economy. And it continues to worsen. Evidence of this can be seen in the fact that the banking holdings of dollar claims have decreased from $7 trillion in 2021 to $6.4 trillion at the end of March 2022. According to an IMF report, the percentage of US dollars in central bank reserves has decreased by 12% since 1999. While the percentage of other currencies, particularly the Chinese yuan, have shown an increasing trend with a 9% rise during this period. For instance, to boost global commerce and Indian exports, the Reserve Bank of India devised in July last year a rupee settlement mechanism to fend off pressure on the Indian currency. India has recently concluded agreements for currency exchanges of $75.4 billion with the UAE, Japan, and various South Asian nations. New Delhi has also informed South Korea and Turkey of its non-dollar mediated exchange rates for each country's currency. Currently, Turkey conducts business utilizing the national currency of China, yuan, and Russia, ruble. Iran has also proposed to the Shanghai Cooperation Organization euro-like STO currency for trade among the Eurasian bloc to stop the weaponization of the US dollar-dominated global financial system. Moscow and Beijing have already set up a cross-border interbank payment network similar to SWIFT, increased their gold purchases to give their currencies more stability, and signed agreements to swap national currencies in several regional and bilateral deals. The trend towards de-dollarization in international trade, particularly among the BRICS nations, has gained significant momentum in recent years. Together, they represent 41% of the world's population, 24% of its GDP, and 16% of its commerce. In 2015, the BRICS New Development Bank recommended the use of national currencies in trade. 4 years later, the bank provided 25% of its $15 billion in financial assistance in local currencies and plans to increase this to 50% in the coming years.
The United States and yet again another shooting with mass fatalities. Around a dozen people were killed and about the same number were injured in a mass shooting in the largely Asian city of Monterey in Southern California. Eyewitnesses said the assailant opened fire indiscriminately with a semi-automatic weapon at an event in Monterey Park as the local community was celebrating Chinese Lunar New Year. Captain Andrew Mayer of L.A. Sheriff's Department said officers had responded to emergency calls at around 10:20 p.m. on Saturday and found people pouring out of the premises. He said the officers made entry to the location and located additional victims. Police say the victims were transported to numerous local hospitals and were listed in various conditions from stable to critical. Witnesses said there was a shooter with a machine gun who had multiple rounds of ammunition on him so he could reload. It is still unknown whether the suspect knew his victims or whether it was a targeted attack. Investigations are underway into the shooting to find out the motive behind it and whether or not the incident was a hate crime. But the factors that lead to tragedies like the one in Monterey Park are deeply ingrained in U.S. politics, culture, and law. As defined by the Gun Violence Archive, a mass shooting is an incident during which four or more people are shot. The Monterey incident is the 33rd such mass shooting that has taken place in the U.S. already since the beginning of this year. It follows shootings at an MLK Day celebration in Fort Pierce, Florida, and a shooting that killed six people in Goshen, California, on that very same day. The Monterey shooting also follows numerous such events last year, including at a Walmart in Virginia, the one in Colorado Springs, Colorado, a shooting on a school bus allegedly targeting members of the University of Virginia football team, and a 4th of July parade in Highland Park, Illinois, last summer. The United States experienced 647 mass shootings last year, illustrating the severity of the issue with guns. Mass shootings in the U.S. come as no other country has suffered such a high death toll from gun violence. Every day, more than 110 Americans die at the end of a gun, including suicides and homicides, an average of more than 40,000 per year. In 2020 alone, more than 45,000 Americans died at the end of a gun, whether by homicide or suicide, more than any other year on record. In terms of the number of incidents, since 2009, there has been an annual average of 19 shootings in which at least four people are killed. The U.S. gun homicide rate is as much as 26 times that of other high-income countries. Its gun suicide rate is nearly 12 times higher. This, as gun control opponents have typically framed the gun violence epidemic in the U.S. as a symptom of a broader mental health crisis. Every country has people with mental health issues and extremists. Those problems aren't unique. What is unique in the U.S.'s expansive view of civilian gun ownership, ingrained in politics, in culture, and in the law since the nation's founding, and a national political process that has so far proved incapable of changing that norm. In terms of the number of guns in the U.S. and how they contribute to the related violence, one estimate from the Small Arms Survey found that there were approximately 390 million guns in circulation in the U.S. in 2018, or about 120.5 firearms per 100 residents. More recent data also suggests that gun ownership grew significantly over the last several years. One study published by the Annals of Internal Medicine in February found that 7.5 million U.S. adults, just under 3% of the population, became first new gun owners between January 2019 and April 2021. But what are the causes of gun violence in the U.S.? Easy access to firearms, a lack of comprehensive background checks and regulations, social and economic factors such as poverty, racism, and mental illness could be named as such. When it comes to the National Rifle Association, the NRA lobbies heavily against all forms of gun control and argues that more guns make the country safer. Despite years of financial woes and internal strife, the NRA remains the most powerful gun lobby in the United States, with a substantial budget to influence members of Congress on gun policy. In January, the NRA filed for bankruptcy as part of a fraud case against some of its own senior staff. Over the last several election cycles, the NRA and other organizations have consistently spent more on pro-gun rights messaging than their rivals in the gun control lobby. Who supports gun control? Despite widespread and vocal public outrage, often in the wake of gun violence, American support for stricter gun laws in 2020 fell to the lowest level since 2014, according to polling by Gallup. 52% of Americans surveyed said they wanted stricter gun laws, while 35% said they should remain the same. 11% surveyed said laws should be made less strict. Last year, Congress reached a deal on limited gun reforms for the first time in nearly 30 years, but the recent shootings underscored just how embedded gun violence is in the U.S. To the solutions. Some argue for stricter gun control laws, such as universal background checks, banning certain types of weapons, and increasing funding for mental health services. Others argue for a more permissive approach, such as loosening restrictions on gun ownership and emphasizing the importance of the Second Amendment.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamidi.
Islamidi.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the merciful, salam, dear listeners, my brothers and sisters from every single corner in the world, wherever you are, I hope you're doing well. This is IRIB English Radio, and here is your favorite youth station. My name is Asma.
Choo-choo-ka-choo, it's the youth station for
yes.
You. That is
that's
our
the slogan.
Tagline. Right,
yes,
right
that's
there.
The tag. My name is Asma, and I'm glad to be at your service, sharing some priceless moments together here with us. We have
Muzaffar Haider.
Yes, we have our brother Muzaffar. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good, though I have a little cold, but it's okay.
Inshallah, may Allah bless you and protect you, inshallah.
Yes, thank you very much. It's not Corona, though. Well, speaking of cold and sickness, mm-hmm. There was a time in my life, I'm talking of my own personal experience, right now, when I experienced a time, an era in my life where everything was falling apart and they were running out of my control. Mm-hmm. At the very beginning of the pandemic, my father got sick, like very sick, in a very bad way. And there was not much of knowledge about the sickness. Mm-hmm. And yet he got the worst form of it. Mm-hmm. And all we had to do was just praying. Beside our personal problems, there was a sickness, mm-hmm. and everything was just running out of control. I'm just thinking about some other people who are going through some exact situations like me. In those times, you really are hopeless. You don't know what you're going to do.
So I was talking to my friend and he was like really miserable. He was down, you know, he's one of those friends who's always upset, right? And I wanted to cheer him up. I said, listen, he was like, no, it's really bad right now. I was like, listen, just to give you some comfort, it's not just you that's suffering right now. The entire world is in like a bad place right now.
Yes.
And not to sound insensitive, like I understand that it
no,
was
that's sympathizing actually.
But it feels for me
at the moment it's very difficult for the one to understand that.
Right. But for me it was like, okay, it's almost like you feel a togetherness with others when you start to realize it in that way. Because sometimes, you know, you're in a difficult situation and nobody can understand it.
Yes, exactly.
But then I feel like in the corona times, humanity's a very weird part of it has started to identify
to
itself.
Show up, yes.
Yeah, you know,
we're
it
all the same in the same
yeah,
boat.
Yeah, we're all in the same boat. Doesn't matter if you're rich or poor. Doesn't matter if you're this or that. You know, we're
everyone
all
is vulnerable.
Asantum, asantum.
Recommendations for those who are feeling they're in a time that everything is falling apart and everything is going out of control and they don't know what they should do.
I want to say patience, but it would sound like so much of a cliche. Like, oh,
do you practice
that? I try, but I'm very impatient, if I'm being totally honest. You know,
I think everyone is so impatient.
وَخُلِقَ الْإِنسَانُ ضَعِيفًا.
Exactly.
We are
that's
just
our essence.
We're very, very weak.
Yes.
You know, mankind has been created weak and we are, you know, a little bit of pressure and we buckle.
Yes, exactly.
And you know, one extraordinary thing that I really did experience just recently is I was going through a sickness, right? I was just sick.
Yes.
You know, that's all I was sick. And at one point, I was just like, astaghfirullah, I shouldn't even be saying this.
Yes, I know what you mean. That happens to everyone.
You know, I just felt like, God, why?
Yes.
For crying out loud, why? You know?
And right now, why right now?
But as soon as I said that, it kind of just stopped. And it was really bizarre because I actually felt that that was Allah's test and I had just failed.
Yes, that's true. You know? It happened to me too.
You know, and I wish I had not lost my temper. I wish I'd been more patient.
Yes, but that's very difficult.
It's very difficult.
Very difficult.
And before that, though, I was like, you know, Ya Allah, I want to be like Prophet Ayyub.
Yes.
You know, I Prophet Ayyub
but
would
the
put
pressure,
through so many.
But the pressure, exactly when you say that, the pressure is more visible.
Uh-huh.
And then right after that, you would lose your temper.
Oh, yeah, you do. Practically speaking, it's a whole different story. And most of us do fail. We can't put up with a little bit of tribulation in this world. You know, there's a hadith, sister, that says that those who pass away from here, right, they go into the barzakh, they go into the world of the grave.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them will be wishing that they had been cut to pieces with scissors in this dunya.
God. Yes, yes.
Because of how much it would have alleviated their pains on that side.
Yes,
get it right.
So
the more you suffer,
strange.
Pain really is a cleanser, especially over here.
Yes.
The more suffering you endure over here, the less you will.
There's a growth system behind that, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe God's blessing comes through afflictions. The more you're going through pains, and the more God is taking you in his hands, in his arms, and the more you are going to have blessings. But at the difficult, at those miserable situations that you have, it's very difficult to understand that.
Absolutely,
because
yeah.
days are going so hard, and they look like every day looks like a century. So for a human being who is so weak and fibbling, it's very difficult to tolerate those situations.
When we wake up on that side, like after death, we are going to, literally life is going to feel like the twinkling of an eye or a single day.
Of course, yes.
And yet when you are in that moment of pressure and pain and suffering,
everything
feels like forever. It just feels like an eternity. I was actually talking to a youth just last night. I was trying to explain to this youth about the existence of hell.
Yes.
Lots of people, especially in the Western world, they have a real problem with fathoming or accepting that hell really does exist.
Well, that does exist.
They have a problem accepting it, right?
Because there are those who really deserve to go in hell.
Exactly. And that's exactly what I said. I said, look, those who deserve to go to hell, you don't understand what their essence actually is. If you recognized what a true kafir is, not the average, you know, John or Joe walking down the street, but an actual kafir, if you knew what was inside their soul, how psychopathic they are, how much they lack empathy, how much hatred and jealousy they have.
How much brutality we've seen through history.
But see, I was talking him through this and we came on to the idea of suffering. And this youth, he said something really remarkable. He said, do you know what? I think that Allah created suffering for a reason. And that reason is to reform us.
Exactly. Why? To shape us.
To shape us, right? Yes. So the more you suffer, you'll notice that the more you really do shine.
Yes,
right?
Like the story of diamonds. They go through so much of pressures.
Right?
And scientifically speaking, we could say that the more they go through pressures, the more beautiful and precious they are.
It's the hardest substance that we know of.
Yes, exactly.
Right. Okay, so then he said, okay, that explains hell. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, if suffering was created for our reformation, if we refuse to reform ourselves, the suffering will continue and it will get worse and worse and worse. And that's why they are in hell.
Yes, that's very true.
Isn't that profound?
Yes, of course.
See, one thing I've learned talking to youths is that you don't always need to give them answers. If you just ask them the right questions, they come up with the right answers themselves.
Little by little, step by step, we get to the conclusion that there is a reason behind suffering.
But since we're on the subject of patience, I came across a really scary verse of the Quran. It said that those who are put into hell, they'll be told, now, if you be patient or you be impatient, it will make no difference.
Exactly.
You are going to be in hell
now. The time has passed.
Allah,
you have done what you have done.
Right? So even if a person says, you know, I'm going to be patient and endure this patiently, does not make a difference. You're in hell now.
Yes.
It doesn't change. Okay. So now let's come out of hell for a moment. Come back to ourselves, right?
So we're speaking of the situations where everything is going out of control.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we talked about patience and we said that practicing patience is very difficult, but it has got some blessing in the end.
Absolutely. So there's this verse, hadith from Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Yes.
He says that there are two days in a man's life, one which is with him and one which is against him.
Yes, against him.
As for the day which is with him, he should be thankful.
Don't be so happy.
He should be thankful.
Yes.
Right. And as for the day which is against him, he should be patient.
Patient, yes.
And I really do feel like, and I feel like a hypocrite for saying this because I don't practice it. May Allah give me the tawfiq to practice it.
Of course, to every single one of us.
Islam is actually showing us a kind of ilahi amin, a kind of attitude that we're supposed to develop.
Yes.
We don't have this attitude.
Yeah.
You know, sister, I was talking to a brother who was actually anxious. He was suffering anxieties and stuff, right? And I told him this hadith. And he said, yeah, I know. I said, but then he goes, but when I'm having a good day, I'm worried that it's going to turn bad any moment.
Exactly. Right? Exactly.
He's just worried.
That's one of my anxieties as well.
There you go. And we all
do.
So
we don't even enjoy the good days.
Exactly. Now, what is Ali alayhi salam telling us here? He's telling us when you're having a good day,
just be thankful.
Be thankful. Don't be worrying, oh, it's going to turn bad any moment. Yeah. Any moment now, a boulder is going to fall on my head. It's
you know,
start
as
raining.
You get older and you're more experienced,
you become pessimistic.
Based on your experiences, you become pessimistic.
So what Islam is actually teaching us is, look, you're going to have ups and downs.
Yeah.